Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Stone and Tile Show. I am your host, Fred Houston, and I know I've been away for a couple of weeks. I've been out all over the country here running around doing stone and tile inspections, but we are back. And if you remember our last show, which was 2 weeks ago, we were interviewing John Kistler with Mapei Corporation, and we're going to get John on the line here in a few more minutes to continue that interview since we have a lot more to discuss. We also have some questions that came in via email earlier today that we're going to address once John gets online here. It looks like he's almost here. Before I get John on, let me just read his bio real quick. I'm not going to read the lengthy bio I read last time. If you want to go back and do that, go back and look at the last show. But basically, John has been with Mapei Corporation's technical services for just over 4 years. He started working with contractors and homeowners alike while with their product support team. He is currently one of Mapei's architectural advisors in technical services and works closely with Mapei's architectural team, as well as with architects and designers. John is well-versed in the TCNA Handbook of Ceramic Glass and Stone Tile Installations, ANSI standards, CAD, and specifications, as well as general product knowledge. And let me get John in here and welcome him in. There we go. John, are you there?
We're here, Fred. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing just wonderful, and you?
We're doing good. Thank you for inviting me to the show again. It's a great opportunity.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah, so glad to be back on here. Actually, I was down in your neck of the woods the other day and doing some inspections, but I was going to call you, but I didn't have time to stop, so I had three inspections.
Yeah.
In one day. But anyway, I want to continue our interview that we had 2 weeks ago now, but before I do, just before the show, I mean literally about 10-15 minutes before the show, I got emailed a question from a lady that we kind of addressed this a little bit, but I want you to kind of address. Let me read you the question she has. It says, we have a shower floor that appears to be absorbing water in addition to draining the water away. The reason after we started using it, the floor started to appear saturated and waterlogged. That was 3 months ago. It seemed to dry up at that point. Our tiler is wondering if the bed has somewhat disturbed during its curing, if the slope is insufficient. Is there hope for this floor? How would you address that question?
Well, that's a great question, Fred, and thanks for forwarding the photos because, you know, I did have a thought-out response, but after seeing the photos, it clarifies things. And just for our listeners' advantage, I'd like to let them know that this appears to be like a small 3/8-inch marble mosaic. I believe you said it was a Calcutta. It's hard to tell. It might be a honed, but I can't tell if it's honed or polished because that has an effect on it. It's also got a linear drain, and it's got tile for the perimeter walls and then a little bit of, I can't tell if that's tile or stone at the curb. But the bottom line is it's darkening, starting at the linear drain, and then about halfway it's starting to transition into a lighter color, and then it's got one small blotch of dry, appears a marble color in the center of it, and then it is a medium dark against the rest of the installation towards the back wall. So, you know, my first thought is a couple things. One, it's the, you know, what one of our callers, one of our listeners that called in with in our previous interview, and is that they've got this darkening stone, which clearly indicates absorption of the water. Now, the tile, if it was from setting, it would have been dark when they from the installation. This was from the description, this didn't happen until after the installation. So what we have, though, is water saturation. There is typically no weep holes at a linear shower entrance. There's a couple manufacturers that have been addressing this, but I'm going to just go reach out and say it's a topical installation of waterproofing, which I believe the brand name, I don't know if you said that, what was done, but it was a sheet membrane. I can leave it at that. And what it also appears, though, is that the gathering of water had started at the linear drain and then worked its way back into the installation. And so, you know, first off, how can you prevent that from happening? Number one, we started to get into this again last show, is that I think this is a perfect case for what we call the six-sided or all-sided ceiling. That will help the edges not to absorb moisture. It'll help the bottom not to absorb moisture. And, of course, depending on whether it's polished or not, because typically water is not going to enter from the top of a polished stone because it's so dense the bilby layer, I think, that's on top of the stone when it's polished?
It's called the bilby layer.
Thank you, sir. Okay, I knew I had most of it. The B word. But anyway, so if you put a drop of water on a polished stone, you're going to see that it pretty much is like putting it on a wax car and it's just going to beat up. And then depending on the porosity, it may start to darken over a period of time, the longer it sits. But typically, in this type of situation, the water is absorbing through the grout into the edges of the stone. And then it can then go from wet always seeks dry. So then it can also then start to accumulate into the thin set and then into the bottom of the stone. The sides and the bottom of the stone are rough, so that allows more moisture to absorb. And then the top of the stone being very, all the minerals pores are sealed off from the polishing process. So that's going to tend to just hold the water and the moisture in there. For only being dry a week, as was stated, this particular one, the only thing that I can see, number one, that's going to get it dry is to utilize a commercial dehumidifier and put it in the room for about 2 or 3 days. You got to really watch it because it will start to dry out your room tremendously. So if you've got wood frame structure and if you've got a higher humidity environment, that could start to dry out your framing in the construction as well. So you have to really watch this. The other thing, then, once it's dry, the only thing you can try to do is to go ahead, and if it's not honed, hone it. And if it is honed, then just go ahead and reseal it, because it's already not working sealed, or if it is sealed from the beginning, it's already creating an issue. Other than that, there's not a lot of hope for this particular installation once they're installed. If you were to have installed it by pre-sealing, all-sided sealing, where you literally dunk the stone in a specific qualified sealer, then you've got a chance of at least keeping this moisture-sensitive stone from grabbing this water so quickly. Will it, work 100%? I can't honestly say that, because they're all different applications. The installers are different. The products are different, but that would be a way to help steer it off. It's either that or, change your material to a porcelain look-like instead of the stone.
Yeah, and of course, what we don't know here, obviously, too, is neither one of us have actually gone out and inspected the shower, so it could be an installation issue as well, not just a material issue. But one of the questions I was going to ask you, and you've already brought it up, had to be on the six-sided ceiling, and I know you guys actually have found it. You guys have a paper out, a technical paper that tells you how to go about doing that. And the question I had there, obviously, you can't use standard mortar when you do a six-sided ceiling, because these sealers are designed to repel water. And if you're using a standard setting material, I would think it wouldn't bond properly. So do you recommend a particular type of setting mortar, and grout for that matter, when you're using that six-sided method?
Okay, again, that's an awesome question. And let me clarify. Actually, with the sealers that we have recommended in that paper, and I could pull it up, so bear with me a second on the actual names that we have from MAPE, but there actually is a bond that is created with our traditional mortars, so we don't have to use a specialized grout. Yep, we don't have to use a specialized grout. We don't have to use a specialized thin set. However, Where the specialized part comes in is with the mortar itself. So I'm just trying to pull up, so bear with me for a minute here. So
yeah,
in the
I remember
meanwhile,
reading that. I can't.
Yep. So in the meanwhile, what's going to happen though is by doing that sealer and then using a traditional mortar, that's allowing you not have to use specialized materials. Now, what is also recommended is after that mortar after the stone is installed and after it's grouted, I would probably tend to lean towards using the MAPE Ultracolor Plus FA, as long as it doesn't scratch the stone, or if it's a honed stone, that will fit, and providing the grout joints are meeting the minimum 1/16 inch size. If they're on the sheets and they're tighter than 1/16 inch, then you're going to be forced to use the MAPE Caracolor U, which is our unsanded grout. So it's really important to, first, again, identify what your type of material and what the sizes are, because the Ultracolor Plus FA does offer the widest range. I'd like to call it more of a universal grout, because it is 1/16 that typically would be unsanded and goes all the way up to 3/4 inch for the sanded. But if you don't have that to begin with, you're already getting into some dicey territory with the grout joint size not being accomplished. And I'm
right,
just
now, one
about
thing,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, one thing she brought up, I'm not sure I emailed you the complete question, but she asked if would it be possible to tile over this installation. So what would you say to that?
Yes, that's absolutely a possibility. And, again, you would have to test your material to make sure that that you can get a bond. And in that case, I would prefer we have a Eco Prim Grip, which is our bond-promoting primer, but even more than that, I would lean towards, if you can abrade this, you could probably use an antiquing brush on this very nicely, get that abraded, and then use something like our Carelastic Care Bond, or even better yet, because of the tightness of the stone and everything, our Granny Wrap system, which is, a liquid. I think we touched base a little bit last time, but the liquid and the powder with no water at it, because that's a rapid set. So depending on what you want to put on top of it, but absolutely can be tiled on top. Now, where the issue is going to be the drain and the drain grate, and addressing how to modify that. But enough money will buy about anything you need for this one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it sounds like she might be better off tearing this out and having it redone right. But again, you and I haven't seen it other than in photographs.
Yeah,
it's really hard to tell.
Right. Extremely difficult to tell.
So let me complicate it. I know we can spend a lot of time on this subject, and I kind of want to move on, but let me just address one more thing, which is kind of another question, which can happen in this situation, but can happen in also situation, and that is, what if we're dealing with a tile or a stone that has no absorbency to it, i.e. a resin back or a fiberglass back material? What would you recommend there? In both a shower situation and a flooring situation.
Well, and here's the thing with that. Depending on the size, so if there are these little mosaics, there's not a lot you can do. And first off, you shouldn't even put that type of stone inside of a wet area, period.
Amen.
So
amen.
Then that's number one. But still, we still have, I would not consider your bathroom a wet area. And I would have no problem getting that installed with our MAPE's Care Epoxy 410, which is strictly a epoxy bonding mortar. We have a couple other ones that could be used, would be our Care Epoxy CQ, and then utilize that in the number 38 Avalanche White if it's a white material similar to this, because now that gives you a bright white for the semi-translucent tile that you have here, and then that same product, if it didn't scratch the surface, could also be used to grout with. Otherwise, you'd have to stick again with our traditional grouts of either the unsanded or the Ultracolor Plus FA.
Good, good, good. Now let's keep in the same realm since we're talking about this, and let's talk about, this is a steam shower. What would you recommend for installing a steam shower with either, let's forget about the white marbles. and we could probably talk limestones too, but we won't get into that.
Thank you.
the steam showers, you know, let's say you're using a, you know, a porcelain tile in a steam shower, any special requirements from the standpoint of setting mortars or grouts?
Absolutely. And the first thing, the steam shower is a very critical installation from the beginning to the end. So it's going to, everything is going to be affected from the framing side out and the material selection. You know, this is definitely a installation that I would not use, even think about using a type 1 organic type setting material. The next thing that's before the setting is to make sure that you have the proper insulation. You know, really go over that TCNA handbook. You know, get yourself familiar a little bit with the ANSI guidelines, to some of the numbers that are used in the handbook, and make sure that you plan out from the beginning that you're going to hopefully have a 2-inch per foot sloped ceiling on it. Now, it's more critical on a 24-hour usage, like a commercial steam room versus residential. The worst that you'll have happen in a residential is you get a little bit of dripping on the head and a little cold water spots. But, you know, when it's running day in and day out, some of those are running 24 hours, then it's a lot more critical for, you know, getting that water off the ceiling. Aside from that, you know, our typical setting materials could be, I personally would recommend any of our, more advanced setting materials such as our Ultraflex LFT if it's a large sized porcelain. Granny Wrap system is always a great product to use in all installations. Ceiling setting can be a little bit unique, so sometimes it actually depends on your troweling abilities to create a suction to the ceiling with, by your trowel pattern. Some people have actually recommended troweling in a circle from the center radius out, and allegedly that helps create a better suction by not letting air out or in, where normally you would otherwise use directional troweling. Sometimes putting, you know, tilt sticks up might help. Sometimes just making the mortar mix just right, where it's a little, it's not too tight. Let's put it that way. So again, there's a lot of techniques that and products that need to be utilized in this. The other thing is all corners need to have slip joints, as we would call them. So nothing is hard mortared in a corner from the cement board out, or if it's a mortar system, you should have a break in the wire. And you know, people are going to contradict this, but the way it should be is a break in the wire, break in the mud, allow there to be that movement joint in the corner, and carry it all the way through to the perimeter joint that would normally now be a sealant instead of a hard mortar joint, you know, for grout. So all of those items are really critical to abide by. And as far as the grout itself would be, you know, still the same thing. Our Ultracolor Plus FA is great. I would rather use that than epoxy because epoxy is so brittle and it doesn't allow for movement. So if you have soft joints where they need to be, epoxy is okay. But if it's a huge steam shower, and then that means you're going to have to put a soft joint in the middle of the grout somewhere to alleviate for that expansion and contraction.
Exactly. And I guess the last piece of advice I'd have for this individual that sent this question is you know, you obviously heard that there's a lot to this. I'm assuming she's not a tile installer and a layperson, so my recommendation would be, and I'm sure, John, you can back me up here, would be to make sure you contact someone that knows what they're doing, a professional. You know, preferably a certified tile installer, but if you can't get a certified tile installer, at least someone that has a lot of experience installing this type of material. Which brings me to another interesting question, since we're on showers.
topic of the day. I like it.
Yeah, really. I didn't mean to do this, but it just so happens it's an interesting topic. One of my inspections that I did the other day was a large, very large condominium complex with, I don't know, several hundred units in there. And I'm talking to the installer, and I'm asking him the standard questions, you know, how did you install this, blah, 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 blah. In the showers, he made this statement, and I want your opinion here. He says, we waterproof the pans, but we normally don't waterproof the shower walls. And I kind of went, oh, okay. Let's talk about that. What's your opinion there?
Okay, here's the deal. First off, it's only been recently, and I'll call recently within the last 15, 20 years, that we've started doing these sheet membranes, and then within the last 8-10 years we've come out with the liquid waterproof membranes. And before that, we were putting organic adhesive on drywall in showers. So, you know, does it, you know, what's changed and why is this such a concern today? Well, when I was doing my showers, because I, as you mentioned, I've gone back, you know, over 35 years of installing. And what I always did was I lined, first I always insulated the bathroom cavity. So it didn't matter if it was a steam shower, just help for sound. It makes sense. You know, who wants to have a noisy bathroom? And it's not just a shower, but obviously there's a toilet in that room too. Then I would cover the studs. Most of mine was wood frame construction with a 6 mil poly. You know, 4 mil is okay, and I recommend it, but I would always just do a 6 mil poly plastic sheeting on the walls and, if necessary, the ceiling. And then the and this was going with a traditional pan liner, so I was typically using a CPE liner, so there's no plasticizers to escape over time and get brittle. And then that line, then the vapor barrier would overlap the liner. So when I used cement board, it wasn't an issue if moisture got into the absorbent cement base material, because if there was any type of transgression of moisture or humidity, it was hitting the vapor barrier and then dripping down back into the shower pan. These days, a lot of times those materials aren't used, but you also have different things such as, let's say, some of the foam boards that have waterproofing on the surface, or you have the liquids that get installed, or you have this, you have that. So it depends on what his exact installation is, but it can be successful with the correct method, but there's, you know, newer, easier ways to do it, and it's when you start to compensate. Or I did a job in Chicago. It was actually of a one of our local Chicago film star, and in this particular unit, it was a condo unit that they, it was a $4 million project, including, you know, obviously the cost of the unit, and it cost $1 million in repairs after the high-end construction work was done. And one of the things that was in there, the pan liner, so it was a CPE pan liner, was adhered to the surface of the cement board, and then everything was tiled. Well, what's wrong with this picture? So needless to say, every shower in his unit was leaking, and so we had to take it out and to do a jigsaw puzzle to put it back together where it was seamless, so we didn't have to do a total gut of the job. That was my specialty to do. So, you know, that's where we really get into some treacherous territory these days, is because of our labor scenario and our methodology of things, and then not going by the book and things like that, or how we were taught. So, you know, the installation definitely is a key in this type of scenario.
Absolutely. Let me stop you there for a second, John, and give out the phone number here in case anyone's listening that want to call in with a question for you. And then call in number is 323-870-3968. That's 323-870-3968. Okay, you mentioned a few times here vapor barrier. And you also mentioned waterproofing, or I did, or you did, or we both did. I guess, you know, for obviously installers out there know what we're talking about. But why don't we go back and explain the difference between the two for our architects out there that are listening, and some of the lay people are listening. So what's the difference between a vapor barrier and a waterproofing barrier, and do they need to be used together?
Great question. And typically, and depending on the installation, you would not use the two of them, depending on the application and the permeability of the waterproofing. So, you know, while we were on this subject, and I didn't talk about it, but it was, you know, MAPE's Aqua Defense is a suitable product to put in a steam shower, and it's not required to have a vapor barrier behind the cement board or whatever you're waterproofing. So the advantage of that is now you can make a uniform waterproofed envelope from the ceiling, the walls, and tie it into the drain, whether it be an integrated bonding flange drain or whether it is a a clamping ring drain as long as you've got the waterproofing tied properly into the drain. So if you have just a vapor barrier, again, fine for a typical shower surround or a tub surround, and then let that vapor barrier drape over into the tub or the shower surround where there's typically supposed to be a lip. There was a lot of fiberglass drop-in tubs that got installed years ago that did not have a tile flange on them, and then those would leak like a sieve because there was no way to seal them without that flange. So anyway, then we get into our vapor barrier, and that's just your backup to stop any moisture from getting into the wall cavity. And that's why, same thing, it's critical that it laps over into a pan liner or back into the tub itself. Lastly, though, when you get into the waterproofing, what's nice about the current waterproofing that's been out for a while with the topical is you're saving some steps. First off, you've got your installation that's installed, whether it be cement board or maybe even there's, you know, foam board with waterproofing on it with the newer lightweight materials as well. So when you have all that waterproofing that's on the top layer, now there's less of a chance of moisture penetrating and holding into that substrate. So when you have a substrate that's like a cement board, and let's say it's stuck into the mud shower pan, how they advise you in the TCNA handbook, if your sub base below that isn't properly pitched or the mud isn't properly dry pack mixed, or so many different scenarios can happen, now you're going to be literally wicking water up. I had a job in Arizona years ago that the shower pan was not pre-sloped, the liner was not pre-sloped, and they were getting a leak in the basement, and I just couldn't figure it out because they had the pitch on the surface. Pitch on the surface was perfect, you know, quarter inch or foot, we're fine. But what wound up happening when I did my inspection with my tear out, I had to go to a destructive inspection, and it wound up that there was moisture that got into the pan. It was literally wicking up the cement board, and then it was releasing outside the pan liner. So there wasn't a leak in the pan liner itself, just strictly that wet seeks dry wicking phenomenon, and it literally wicked out of the shower pan because of not having a pitch to the drain, so it's holding water, and then the rest was like a candlestick, and it was wicking the water out of the shower. So, you know, we covered a bunch of topics there, but, you know, this is real life out there, and you have to be able to not only be a good diagnostic, but you have to know of installing properly, but then also of finding a solution if there is a problem like that.
Absolutely. All right, one last question before we get out of the shower. Okay. Let's talk about this term that's being thrown around now in the industry called the divot method. Explain that.
Okay, all the divot method is, it's a way to utilize a topical waterproofing membrane, preferably liquid at this point, but there are some different accessories that are out by other manufacturers. You know, us with our Aqua Defense, what it basically means is you take a typical clamping ring shower drain. It's unbolted, and where you would either hot mop to it or you would put a pan liner to it, those are the typical methods of attachment. But with the divot method, what you're allowed to do is you're allowed to install the let's say a product like our 4-to-1 mud bed mix, and do a dry pack and either do a bonded right to the concrete slab and then right up to your drain flange, the bottom drain flange, or you would do it over wood frame construction where you put your 15-pound felt or plastic down and then, you know, your diamond galvanized diamond mesh, and then you put your dry pack on top of it, and then you would mold it around the bottom flange. One of the tricks that I learned from one of my fellow, and I will throw a plug out there to the John Geekers, and now he's there than the Tile Geekers, is that they would use a 9-inch frying pan. Take off the handle, and the base of that frying pan hit the collar just right on the drain flange, and then the top was funneled out a little, flanged out a little bit wider. It happened to be about 1 3/8 inch thick, which is just perfect for mud bed thickness. You go ahead and you mud it up to that frying pan. You pull out the frying pan, maybe did a cleanup if necessary, and waited for that to dry, and then throw your liquid on it, and that would overlap the divot that was created by the frying pan, and you'd be waterproofed all the way down over to the throat of the drain. So just as simply is a, that's the way we call it. And then in the handbook for professional naming it, it's the TCNA handbook method of the B421, and that would be with this typical three-piece clamping ring drain, and there you have it.
Great. Well, I'm ready to get out of the shower. So let's, and by the way, that's a great tip with the frying pan. I love that. But let's go ahead and switch gears here a little bit. And let's talk about, well, again, this condo complex that I looked at. Obviously, you've got multi-million dollar condos that are using, you know, primarily natural stone. You do see some porcelain and ceramic in there, but they're noisy. So obviously, mm-hmm. we need to use some kind of soundproofing membrane. Let's talk a little bit about sound reduction membranes.
Great. Well, first off, it has to be a consideration is what your ratings for the building are, because, you know, usually there's two types of sound. There's impact sound, which is your IIC, and then there's your airborne sound, which is your STC. And usually as a base, you want to have a 50-50 on the both of those, and they sometimes are more difficult. The impact sound is always the most difficult to accomplish, and especially when you're using hard surfaces such as stone and such as porcelain tile. And then it also it gets a little easier with wood, but obviously your carpeting, for example, is going to have your best rating because it deadens the sound. But with the stone and the tile, you need to, you know, get a rating of a minimum of 50-50. So we have, MAPE has a couple of different solutions for that, you know, depending on what the current rating is, how thick the slab is. Slabs are typically tested and rated at 6 inches. They're either with or without an insulated ceiling below. Very critical, because once you can implement a insulated ceiling with the set thickness of drywall, set hanger grids, set insulation thickness, you can tremendously deaden that sound, and so it makes it easier for the sound reduction membrane that would need to be placed on top. So we've got a couple. We've got our, MapaGuard 2 is an excellent sound reduction product. It's a simple peel and stick, so once your floors are flat, so whether they need a leveler or whether they're already in plane or whether it's going over wood, you can go ahead and use a product like the MapaGuard 2. And I don't have the ratings in front of me, but I do know that we just did get accomplished testing for an 8-inch slab with no additional soundproofing for the MapaGuard 2. So that's nice to know that, you know, we've got, you know, testing on an 8-inch, we've got testing on a 6-inch, and we typically meet all the numbers for both of those settings. Then we also have the newer products of the recycled rubber, which, again, many manufacturers out there, all kinds of sizes, from everything from very thin. Our typical ones that we're carrying right now is the 5mm and the 10mm, and they, again, both have great impact sound ratings to cushion that noise. And what's neat about those is they're not as pricey as your peel-in sticks, but, you know, for 5 and 10mm, you're not going excessively thick either. And then you can bond directly to that with our modified mortars, you know, some of which we were talking about our last topic. So basically, I think we've summed it up. You need a minimum of a 50-50, but check on your local association and building complex to, you know, establish exactly where your ratings need to be, and that'll determine how effective your products that you're going to put down to accomplish that are.
Excellent. But it brings me to another question, though, and that is, let's say I need crack isolation as well as soundproofing. What do we do in that case? Will the same membrane work, or do we need two separate membranes?
No, you got to pray. No.
Yeah, exactly. We've done that lots of
No.
times.
Yeah, exactly. And we always say we're doing this on a wing and a prayer, right?
Yeah,
So
exactly.
anyway, yes, all of our products are both rated as an ANSI A118. Well, actually, let me take that back. We have some products that are rated for crack isolation and waterproofing, and we have the other ones that are rated as for sound deadening and crack isolation. So you have an ANSI 118 12 for the crack isolation, and all of ours meet the standard, I mean, I'm sorry, high performance of 1/8 of an inch in a lateral plane. So, no deflection up and down because no product will help with that. But as far as expansion and contraction, you can expand up to 1/8 of an inch with our MapaGuard RM 5 and 10. And then our MapaGuard 2 will expand all the way up to 3/8 of an inch. So it's tremendous to watch that on a test on a split block, and you keep on expanding it like on the Adams family there, except with the body, you're doing it with tile. And it's really neat to see a product perform all the way up to a 3/8 of an inch opening without cracking the tile that's above it. So yes, we can accomplish the 1/18-13 for sound and the 1/18-12 for expansion.
And that brings up an interesting situation that I run into all the time, and that is when, as an inspector, I go out there and I look at a crack in a floor. Let's say I do a destructive test, and I found that someone bridged a control joint in the slab. Would a product like that work to reinstall over that a control joint?
Yikes.
Or
I'm going to be
how
quiet
would you do
now.
that?
I'm going to be quiet now. Okay. Disclaimer. We're going to maybe mesh and blend Mapei's opinion. I always recommend, number one, as a Mapei representative, to follow the manufacturer's instructions. So, as a guideline, typically for a control joint, it may be safe to go over it. If you want to be 100% safe, then you want to just go ahead and follow just like you would an expansion joint and carry it all the way through the surface. But here's what happens is typically you can have a control joint, and let's just say sometimes what people will do is they'll do a partial. In the TC&A handbook, it's known as an F125 partial for crack isolation. And what that's designed for, it's not designed for control joints. It's designed for open cracks that are already in the slab, and you want to correct that situation so that the crack does not transfer through. And as long as there's no vertical in a plane height difference, it's okay to do that as long as you first pre-treat the crack and then go ahead and go at least 3 tiles wide of your crack isolation material. However, if you don't do the F125 full, what can happen is that concrete can down the road crack somewhere else, and now you've got an unprotected surface. Going back to the control joint, we have Mapei, the typical standard is treated as an expansion joint, but there are exceptions to the rule, and many times installers are doing this all the time with control joints. Is they are going over it, whether with an uncoupling membrane that we have. Our MapaGuard UM is our uncoupling membrane, which is an awesome product, which can also be waterproofed with our seam tape. And then there's also the MapaGuard 2, the RM. All of these products can bridge that, and it's really going to depend on the specific structure and what the job site circumstances are of whether or not you want to, throw the dice and go over it or not. So, but it's a common occurrence, and I'm sure you probably see that in many of
Oh,
your inspections. You might not notice it until you actually do destructive to figure out what's going on.
Yep, it's quite common. It's funny you brought up exceptions to the rule. I always tell my students in my inspection classes, I said, I love this industry because I can never be wrong because there's an exception to the rule. I tell you, there's always an exception, and it's so true in this industry. So, again, going back, that's why we have guidelines, and that's why we should follow them. Let's switch gears again, John, so we can get all these topics in. Let's go to sealers, enhancers, the finishes. maintenance problems, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess the first question I have is there a silver bullet for sealing stone?
Wow. No. You know, I'm going to have to, you know, honestly, I'm going to say no, because we have dense stones with a very tight crystal structure, and then we have, you know, very grainy stones. And then we have things like, you know, polished stones and unpolished or honed stones. And we have textured granites that have been water jet finished, bush hammered finished, split faced. So with all those combinations, and even with one sealer that might work in one application, it might not work in another. So absolutely, there is no silver bullet. Even you buy, whether it be some of our best sealers that Mapei has to offer, you know, we have a water-based sealer. One of them is our porous, penetrating plus stone tile and grout sealer. And then we have a solvent-based sealer, which one of the newest technologies we have is the penetrating SB, stone tile and grout sealer, which is a solvent base. Hence the SB. We're really creative, as I mentioned last time with our, our names. But anyway, no such thing as the silver bullet. If we did have a very porous stone, that's when we want to use the penetrating plus stone tile and grout sealer, which is the water base, as I mentioned. Then you have some granites. There are some granites that don't even need a sealer. So I don't know if you're familiar, but years ago, there was some of our local box stores that would sell a granite and say that, hey, we've got a 10-year sealer on them. We got a this sealer on them. Well, it probably helped that those were igneous stones that they were sealing. So the worst case scenario that we'd run into is here you have this igneous stone that does not require a sealer. It passes the oil test. It passes the lemon test. And so there's no penetration. In fact, actually, the sealers, if you actually did put it on that type of stone, can sit on the surface. And I've had to remove many times a sealer that was applied to that type of stone just because when the water rings were from your glasses etching the top of the surface and they thought it was damaging the stone, that wasn't it at all. The stone, the sealer was actually being damaged. And once you removed the sealer, all of a sudden the stone was perfect and you could throw it a pop and wine and salad dressing and whatever you wanted at it, and nothing was going to happen to it. All you had to do was clean up with your, you know, neutral or high alkaline cleaner. Now with the more porous stones, if you don't mind, I got a minute to explain it. Is our impregnating sealer? Okay, thank you. Our impregnating sealers, just for our layperson out there, I don't like the word sealer. I was learning when we were writing this up for the MIA, or the Marble Institute of American Knowledge, the National Stone Institute, is that we should be calling these repellents, because that's all they're doing is repelling, and they're giving you some reaction time to get there and get that product, whatever could be damaging to the surface, off. And once we say sealer, well, now we think of something being totally encapsulated and protected. So if someone's going to say, well, I sealed my marble. Why is it still doing this? It's a bad sealer. You did a bad job. You didn't do the right product. No, that's not it at all. It was strictly a repellent that got put on. And unless you did a finish, and I think that was one of my other topics that I had here, that would then basically be like your floor wax. So we've got some acrylic finishes here at Mapei as well. And so with those products, you can put on what we would call a sacrificial layer or a wear layer, you know, that protectant that covered. So, yes, you're going to have more maintenance to apply and strip, apply and strip, but it will protect you. Say, for example, I've done some of my bathrooms that were polished stone, and I would go in there with a topical acrylic sealer, and we would protect the toilet rooms. We wouldn't put them in the rest of the bathroom. We would just put them in the toilet rooms because some reason there's splatter in those rooms. And so the bullseye is not hit very often. So it winds up, though, that when the uric acid hits the polished stone, it doesn't create the etch marks. But again, those type of coatings or finishes need to be maintained. They're also not recommended for wet areas. So in a shower, I've done a lot of restoration work where they put on a finish in the shower and then that finish would cloud because moisture got behind the finish, and then it started to erode and break down the finish. So just think of it that you want to use an impregnating sealer, which I would like to call a repellent from this point forward, but it's in more proper terms. And then depending on the specific impregnating sealers that are out there will depend on the price is going to dictate what the solid content is, which the solids within those penetrating products are the ones that will get into either the tiniest of crevices, which are typically the solvent-based products, versus fill a large open pore surface, which would be, you know, the water-based surface. And then I'll close off with, they also have, you know, your fluoropolymer solids versus some type of a silicone or silicon product that's being used. So different uses for different products for different applications.
And the only thing I'll add to that, and that was a great explanation, is that, and this goes especially for you contractors are out there, you have to be very careful in the terminology. Because when you say sealer to a person that doesn't know our industry, they're thinking, as you said, a coating, a finish or whatever. And what I used to get constantly back in the day is, okay, we put this quote-unquote sealer, which is really a repellent, on their stone surface, and it doesn't look any different. There will be no look and difference other than, and this is my next question, other than the possibility that some of these repellents can darken certain stones. Am I correct?
That is absolutely correct. And when I was in my contracting business, I got to know every available sealer and enhancer at my disposal, and then I would do, you know, mock-up testing with putting those samples on the stone and see if they truly did not change the color as they claim to. So here in the industry, when you start to get into the enhancing products, you know, they are specifically meant to darken the surface of the stone. So what we have to keep in mind is, to what degree do they want them to be darkened? So, you know, we have the Enhancer Plus, Ultra Care Enhancer Plus from MAPE, and that one has got the highest solid content, and it will literally darken the stone. And then we have, you know, our regular enhancer, Ultra Care Enhancer, and what that product would do is it'll give you like a medium deepening of color. So depending on what you put it on, so you could put, say, the Enhancer Plus on a blue stone or a slate, and it's going to really tone down the color. It might even make it look muddy because, it did give it a wet look, but some people want a wet look, shiny look, and some people want a wet look, dark look. And then some don't want the wet look at all. So, you know, you have to, you know, take these products and sample them on the various materials to see what your end effect is going to be. But they are going to be more resilient of a sealer because of the solids concentrate that are in them. And so they will offer excellent wearability of your, especially they're usually used on your honed products. But there's other tricks that they've been used on edges of fabricated stone, because maybe some of that stone that the fabricators are using was resined, and now you need a product that's going to help darken that edge, because if you just strictly cut and profiled that edge of the granite, now what it's going to do, it's going to go to the lighter core instead of what the resin surface looked like. So now you've got to compensate by either staining and or, you know, finding a good enhancer that would work on that product. So again, great question.
Now, we talked about repellents, we talked about finishes. What we didn't talk about, and we need a little explanation on this, if you will, what is a grout release?
Oh, boy. Again, we've got MAPE is infamous for this, but we've got a product called Grout Release. And guess what it does? It releases grout. And so,
which is important.
It's very important. Let's just, you know, use a couple of examples. Now, one of the most extreme ones is the days that they're still out there. I haven't seen them in a while, but I know they still exist, are your abrasive quarries, you know, that they're using in commercial kitchens and dairies and things like that, so that when there was grease that would get on that floor, those little sand particles that were literally, you know, stuck in the face of the quarry tile. But you try to grout that thing without any type of a coating on it, your grout is not going to come clean and off the top of the face of that tile. You know, nowadays we have other things such as some of these plank tiles that have very deep grains in them. And many times because of now we can use these universal grouts that I talked about that, you know, they're rapid setting, they're, you know, rated as a high performance grout like our UltraColor Plus FA. And what will happen, though, is now that grout and that pigment can get into that little fine graining that's in the wood grain. So no matter how hard you clean it, and sometimes you got to go back after it with a scrub brush. But if you don't get it right the first shot, you know, now you've got to usually take an acidic product and get it out. And that's where we get into the problem solvers that we can touch base in a minute. But in the meanwhile, the grout release, it's basically, if I could give it a simple term, is like, you know, putting a liquid detergent on top of the tile or the stone surface. And what that'll do is that you put on one or two coats depending on, you know, how absorbent the material is. Let that dry, and then you come back and you grout it. And whether it be with an epoxy grout or with a, you know, high performance grout, now when you go to wash it, you're pulling the grout film off of the grout release, and then you're starting to then dig down and you're dissolving the grout release that's on there. So you're kind of getting a two for one where you've not sealed the tile, but you've put a safe protection on the top that does come off with, you know, simple the grout cleaning process, and then maybe another cleaning process after that, depending if there's any residue left.
So that brings up another interesting question. Now, you've just done this a tile floor. You have to use a grout release on whatever particular tile you're working with that's very absorbent, and the customer or you wants the grout. And we'll use that awful word again. They want to seal the grout. How long do you usually wait?
Okay, again, depending on the products that are out there, you know, our UltraColor Plus FA can typically be sealed after 24 hours. Then when you get into your more cementitious grouts, the rule of thumb is 72 hours. But what's important, too, to realize, though, is depending on the size of the tile and how thick the setting bed was, that also has an effect on the grout. So, you know, first you want to make sure you hold off on your grout until you've got substantial drying out of the setting bed, and then, you know, the proper cure time on the setting bed before you attempt to seal.
All right. Now, you mentioned grout haze before, so I'm going to have to ask you this question. Let's say I messed up and I've got a grout haze. How do I go about removing it?
Okay, usually a jackhammer, you know, a good demo hammer does
works.
The job.
That'll work.
Oh, my gosh, I've seen some horrible ones. And it really depends on how we're going to define grout haze, and it's going to also depend on whether it's an epoxy grout haze or whether it's a cement grout haze. And then on the cement grout haze, it's going to depend on what type of grout was used. So let's use a simple one. Let's just say you're using our Caracolor S standard sanded grout. And then let's say upon washing, that overnight film got on there, but it wasn't just on a glazed tile. It happened to be on a matte finished tile. So what will happen is now you've got a haze on there that, according to TCNA and by a lot of standards, ANSI, I believe, has one as well, and they tell you to wait before doing any type of an acidic cleanup to wait 10 days. Well, to me, what that's doing is that's just buying time for that to get harder. So we do have some cleaners. One of them is we do have our sulfamic acid crystals. Those are the safest, most recognized and used product and recommended product for a typical cement grout haze. So, you know, wait your 10 days, or if you're able to, the sooner you can get it up, the better, but I wouldn't do anything sooner than 3 days. And if you just had to get onto it, then make sure you just dampen your grout joints and maybe dampen the surface before you start putting this, you know, sulfamic acid crystals on there. The other thing, let's move into now a little bit more difficult one, would be like our UltraColor Plus or, you know, these newer ANSI 118.7 high-performance grouts. Well, what they have is besides also having the density with the fine aggregate that's in the UltraColor Plus FA, hence FA, get it?
Yeah.
It's fine aggregate. Then what you're gonna have is a higher concentration of acrylic or polymer in the grout, so that's helping it be denser as well as more resilient towards your staining. But it's also making it where your typical sulfamic acid might not break down that grout because it's also got an aluminate oxide in it instead of a traditional cement, Portland cement in there. So between trying to break the aluminum oxide down as well as the acrylic, well, then your simple cement grout haze removers aren't going to work. So now you're going to have to, what I would recommend would be something like our heavy-duty stone tile and grout cleaner, which is a high alkaline cleaner. Of course, alkalines break down polymers and acrylic. So that would typically be your best type of product for that. And then once you get into your epoxy grout, same thing. The biggest key, and I would just want to give a couple hints out there to the installers that may be familiar or might be afraid of these epoxy grouts. Well, number one, they've been water washable for quite some time now. However, if you don't use enough water or you don't change your water often enough or you don't rinse off enough, don't be afraid to use water and an abundance of water on your epoxy grout. And then keep in mind that when you're installing that epoxy grout is to, you know, we've got, you know, our Care Epoxy CQ, which is, you know, a great seller. We've got it available in all 40 colors. So it can go into almost any application that you can put cement grout. And what will happen, though, is if you don't get that film off, don't change the bucket, there is then going to be that epoxy grout haze that's left on the surface. And the longer you let it wait, the harder it's going to be to get off. So a lot of the guys that are familiar with epoxy, they'll go ahead and include to come back the next day. So they just know that their guys are not going to take the time and do all the changing of waters that's required and get in and get out as quick as you can to get on to your next job. So they're going to just say, hey, we know we got a film on there. We're going to go back the next day, and we're going to use, you know, the epoxy grout haze remover. And guess what Mepe calls it? Epoxy grout haze remover.
Grout haze remover.
You can almost just know what product you want to get. Oh, I want thin set. Okay, that's our thin set.
Which is great. You know, another little tip I'll add with epoxy grout, all the years I've worked with it, is a hot water works well too.
Yeah, you know, and that's true, but it also depends, you know, sometimes you can also, they have, depending on the grout itself, they have packets that can be added to the wash water. Sometimes it's an acidic packet. Sometimes it's some other chemical, citrus-based packet that can go with it. And usually we'll find that for sure in our, like our Care Epoxy IEG CQ, which is the high-performance industrial epoxy for commercial kitchens. But one other thing in addition to that that I forgot to mention, Fred, now that you're mentioning it, is that when you're doing that cleanup and is to not necessarily have to keep on wringing your sponge and throwing it up into the bucket and trying to wring out your sponge, but you can literally take something simple as a squeegee and then pull that into a pile and then take another squeegee and throw it into a steel dustpan and then dump that residue into the bucket before you start your water cleanup, or use a wet vac. And again, it's got to be your work wet vac. Better not be the one you got at home for the wife, because she will not be happy with what you get in return. Absolutely.
Sure.
We know where those buttons are, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we sure do.
But anyways, to go ahead and use a wet vac, and again, get rid of all that residue first, and then go ahead and do your water wash with your, you know, white scrub pad, and that's going to also greatly facilitate your cleanup.
Great tip. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, believe it or not, but I think we covered a lot of information. So one last time, John, I want to thank you. If you have any questions for John, why don't you give out the product support and the website.
Okay, thank you. Okay, our product support is 1-800-992-6273. And then for our website, so if you're U.S.-based, it's www.mapei.us. And then if you're somewhere other place around the world, it's www.mapei.com.
And I'll also add, Mapei has always been my paper products I recommend it all the time. So again, thank you, John, and we'll be talking shortly.
Awesome. Thank you, Fred. Had a good time.
Great. Alrighty, folks, there you have it. If you want a little bit more information, you contact John at those numbers there or any of the other technical representatives there. Also, you might want to go back and listen to our first show where we interviewed John, which was 2 weeks ago. That'll be in the archives. In the meantime, I hope everyone has a great weekend. Make sure you listen to us again, every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time. I also have a new video blog that's out, so if you want to get a load of the video blog, send me an email to fhouston, that's F-H-U-E-S-T-O-N at gmail.com. Again, F-H-U-E-S-T-O-N at gmail.com. And we'll see everybody next week. Everyone have a great one.